Okay. In 1993, it was Damien and my first trip to Israel. And anytime you go to Israel, you remember it, but your first trip, you really remember. And every site that we visited, of course, impacted me, still does every time we go. But over the years, the Lord kind of speaks really strongly to me in different places. But that first trip, one in particular, really impacted me. And if you're familiar with the history of the Old Testament, you will remember that after David's reign, his son Solomon reigned, and after Solomon, his son Rehoboam reigned, and that during that time and early in his reign, the kingdom of and the nation of Israel was divided. And a man named Jeroboam rose up and rebelled against Rehoboam. They had reason for not liking the way he was doing things, because he was not doing them according to God's way. And so the kingdom was divided. So 10 tribes went with Jeroboam, and that was the northern tribe of Israel. And then 2 remained, and that was in the kingdom of Judah. So Jeroboam, as a leader then, and they spread out, they had most of the land, and they spread out, and he thought, oh no, when it comes time to worship God at the temple, these people are going to leave, and they're going to go back into Jerusalem, and they're going to worship. So he decided that he would set up 2 places in the northern kingdom for a place to worship. So he set one up in Bethel, and the other one in Dan, which is at the northern part of the country. So on our first trip, we went to Dan. It's called Tel Dan because it was covered in dirt, and they would build city upon city upon city upon city. Well, that during at 1993, they had recently discovered this site. Mostly all of it was under dirt. They had just started uncovering, but they uncovered the very steps to the altar that Jeroboam had made and made that golden calf and set it up so that they could worship this golden calf instead of going into Jerusalem and worshiping God. Well, I remember standing, we were up pretty high because we were on all the dirt. We could just barely see the part where they had dug to start uncovering the steps. Today, we get to go actually sit on the steps and have our Bible study. But at that time, we could just see it. I mean, it's pretty exciting anytime they find something in the land of Israel it was in the Bible. And Pastor Chuck, we went with him, and Pastor Chuck led us in a particular song that was kind of in all the Calvaries, at least at that time. And the song was called "To Keep Your Lovely Face." Ever before my eyes, this is my prayer, make it my strong desire, that in my secret heart, no other love competes, and no rival throne survives, and I serve only you. Now, that song in that site is very impactful because you're seeing, this is reality. This is what they did. They were actually here. They had this golden calf here. All these people are worshiping a golden calf. And so here we're singing this song that I knew very well because we were singing it in church. But even at that time, I did not fully understand a rival throne. I didn't understand idolatry. I understood idolatry in that it took place among God's people, recorded in the Bible, and we were actually at that site. I knew that. I knew the history of that. I knew about Jeroboam. I knew what he did. But it was really hard for me to bring that into real life. I tend to be too concrete and too literal. And so if it's not like in real life and spelled out for me, I can just kind of, I don't know where I go, but I don't go where I'm supposed to go. So I would look at my life and my walk with the Lord and compare it to those dirty, rotten children of Israel who would bow down and worship a gold calf. I mean, for crying out loud, who's going to do that? I'm not going to do that. Therefore, I am not an idolater. Of course, I think that there's a little bit of pride in that, too. Now, I could, like the rest of us, see, you know, those people who make sports their idols, you know. They're the ones who stay home from church because they're watching a game, or they stay home from church because they're taking their kids on the traveling soccer, swim teams, or whatever teams. You know, we know those people, and their idols are the people who worship money and possessions and those things. We know what they are. You look at the parking lot. You can tell what car they drive or what house they live in. You know, those are like obvious, but I mean, I wasn't doing those things. So I suppose that I did not have any idols in my life. And so this lesson of idolatry has been a long process for me. So turn to Exodus chapter 20 so we can get some context in this. Exodus 20, this is where Moses is up on the mountain where God is giving him the Ten Commandments. In Exodus 20, verse 1, and God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make yourself for yourself any carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. And you shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord, your God, am a jealous God. God created us as humans to worship and to worship him. E. Stanley Jones says, all people worship in some form. Animals do not. There seems to be in people a kinship with God that makes us yearn for God in unwordable yearnings. I like that. There's something within us that God put in there. It's in that it was in the dust when he created us. It's in the DNA for us to worship and to worship him. Now, the practice of idolatry, or worshiping something other than God, took place very, very early in creation. Okay, it was part of the fall of man when sin entered the world. Its origin is in Satan. Satan, a created being, a worship leader in heaven at that time, from his own jealousy and envy of God receiving all this praise and worship. He wanted it in his own life out of his own pride and cause his fall. And then he went into the garden to get them, Adam and Eve, to sin. So sin entered the world and man began to live for self, worship of self, selfish desires, rather than God. Abraham, we know from the Bible, Abraham came from a family of idolaters. We also know from the Bible that Rachel stole her father's little gods when they were fleeing from him and hid them from even Jacob, her husband. And when Jacob later on was taking his family back to Bethel, back to the place where he met with God and worshiped God, he told his family, put away the foreign gods that are among you. So this is really early in history. Idolatry, it permeated the world at that time. But only God's people worshiped the true and the living God. But even they were having trouble with that. In our passage here, God reminded the people and reminds us who it is that delivers. He delivered them from the land of Egypt, from the bondage there. And then he gave them the commands of how to live, how to conduct themselves, and how to worship him in a world full of idolatry. They were surrounded by it. All of the images and the worship of inanimate things and the worship of animals and the worship of the sun and the stars and all kinds of crazy things, created things, rather than worshiping the Creator. And God said, you shall have no other God before me. Don't bow down to them and don't serve them. Don't give your life to them. While Moses was on the mountain receiving these commandments, we know what happened. Aaron and all the people were grumbling. He's taking so long. We have a need to worship. Okay, well, give me your gold jewelry and we'll throw it in the fire. And out popped a little golden calf. Now, let's worship that. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So you can see in a concrete, literal mind, it's just like, I don't get that. I don't get that, and I can't, you know, put that against my life. So it's been a process for me to learn. The book of Judges, all through Judges, it said everyone did what is right in their own eyes. Well, that's idolatry. Worship of self. I'm doing whatever I want to do. David, as king, he was a worshiper of God. He loved the Lord and worshiped the Lord and kind of enforced worship of the nation that was kind of just coming together. And he as king, and it was a wonderful, wonderful time. But even when it is kind of an enforced thing, or when you're with a group of people and everybody's doing it, it doesn't change the heart of individuals. So David dies, Solomon, his son, comes in, who was an idolater, and then the divided kingdom, and then you can trace idolatry all through the Bible. Between the Old and the New Testament, which were the 400 silent years, this is where the Pharisees kind of formed. And the Pharisees were a group of religious men who didn't like what was going on. They fought against the idolatry, and they fought against the Greek and the Roman cultures that were coming in and ruling and taking over. And so they wanted to keep the worship of God, and they wanted the biblical commandments, and they wanted to keep the Jewish traditions and the Jewish culture. So what the Pharisees started out with was very good and true and pure, but it turned into, by the time you're in the New Testament and you hear Jesus talking to the religious leaders, these Pharisees, and he's calling them a whitewashed tomb, he says, you strain at a gnat and you swallow a camel. You've taken your religion, your worship, which was good, but now you've fashioned into your own God, your own rules, and now you've elevated that above the true and the living God. So anything that starts out okay can turn into idolatry. Idolatry we see also in the New Testament. Jesus warned against it. You remember when Satan took him out into the wilderness for 40 days, and he tempted Jesus, and Jesus was without food, and he offered him all the kingdoms of the world. All of this is yours, because right now it's under my control, and I will give it to you if you bow down and you worship me. And what did Jesus say to him? Get behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Later, Jesus was asked, what's the greatest commandment? And he said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. In other words, him first, no other God before him. Him first, he is supreme. In Paul's letters, he addresses idolatry. John, in his first epistle, at the very end, he says, little children, keep yourselves from idols. So, you know, knowing all of this from the Bible, I've known all of that from as a brand new Christian. I learned and I knew all that. But we and I can still think we aren't idolaters because we don't have these little carved images or these gold calves or those kind of things that we look, when we think of idolatry, that's what it is. I don't bow down to anything. I don't worship anything. I worship God. I come to church. I'm living for Him. But in simple terms, idolatry is anything or anyone that we put before God, even for 5 minutes. Okay? And that word, that phrase, before me, it doesn't mean before me as in ahead of me. I put it ahead of you. No, it means in my presence, God says. Well, He is in us and He is everywhere, so idolatry should be nowhere near us at all. So anything or anyone that comes into our decision-making before God comes into that decision-making, that's idolatry. I mean, if we just ended there and you went and walked and talked with the Lord just on that, I think there's conviction. I don't mean for this to be super convicting because I'm sharing a life lesson with you. So I'm the one convicted here. If our identity is in anyone or anything other than God, that is idolatry. If our self-worth or approval is from anyone or anything other than God, that's idolatry. Whatever consumes our minds, our thoughts, our attentions, our time, our energy, and our heart, other than God, it's an idol. It is an idol. I don't know if your mind has ever been consumed with any particular thing or person, or most of your attention, and then we don't have the attention to our Bible study or to our time with the Lord. Or that it's an idol. It is idolatry. Idolatry. Somebody said idolatry isn't just one issue or one sin in the whole list of sins. It really is the issue and the sin, because all expression of idolatry leads back to one place, self. So, you know, I always have to go to the bottom line first and then work my way. The bottom line is this person here and this person here and this person here, we are our own idols. We are the one who we are putting before God. It comes in lots of different forms, make it look better. But bottom line, it's me. So whatever we are putting before God in our thoughts, time, actions, its root comes back to self. And we need, obviously, to get rid of self, get rid of that idol, surrender and obedience. So in those terms, I can understand that. I can understand what idolatry is. And then I can say, okay, I've been an idolater. I've had idols in my life. Haven't had any golden calves. Haven't had any images or pictures or carved things or cars. I mean, who cares? House, gonna burn. You know, I'm not a shoe person, I'm not a clothes person, I'm not a purse person, I'm not a hobby person, I'm not, you know, all of those things. But in some forms, I've had an idol in my life. So if I think of it just in terms of those other things, then I can justify myself pretty easy. I don't know if you've ever done that in your own life, justified yourself. I think you have. The Lord has taught me so much concerning idolatry, idol worship. He has shown me so many things. He's revealed so much in my heart. This subject is huge, and it is worth studying. It is worth reading and investigating about. And as I was sitting there and thinking, I need to be careful. I don't turn this into a Bible study because I'm sharing my life lesson with you. That will probably come one day. But I do want to refer you to a very, very good book. Now, who wants to read a book on idolatry? I mean, you know, if you don't want to read a book on idolatry, guess what that might mean? Well, you can fill in the blank. You know what that might mean. But if you really want to have the Lord speak to your heart, and this is a good topic to have him speak to your heart, there's a book called Gods at War, little g, gods. Gods at War, because there are gods warring for our life, our attention, our time. And the book is by a pastor. His name is Kyle Eidelman. And I'm going to refer to that book several times, because I would rather just stand up here and read you the book. It's so good, but you can read it for yourself. Very, very good. I'm in my second time through on this. So very briefly, let's look at a few of today's possible idols that we can kind of downplay or justify in our lives. Unfortunately, Christians, and I'm not pointing anyone out, but, you know, as a whole, not everyone, but as a whole, we're pretty good at fashioning our own gods. I mean, the world does that, but Christians can do it too. And they can pick and choose, you know, what verses they like and what they don't like, what Bible studies they like and they don't like, the topics, that kind of a thing. And we kind of fashion our own religion and our own God. Well, we don't like that church because that church does this, so, you know, let's erase that. And we don't like this because that's really too pointed, and do we see the way the world's going? Don't you think that's a little narrow? So we erase that part out of our Bible, and pretty soon we fashion our own God. We don't like his judgments, we don't like his holiness, his righteousness, or his rules, and so we reject that, and we rewrite them because we want to feel good about ourselves. And so, you know, we don't have to go to church all the time. I mean, come on, why do you have to go to church all the time? You don't have to read your Bible all the time. You know, those kind of things that we just kind of pick and choose, and we justify. Well, I don't want to be legalistic about it, you know. We can just do these things in our mind. We're so good at it. But we want to be very careful we don't create our own God, and like the Pharisees did with their own religion. They were very strict. But today what we're seeing is the liberal end of it. It's that now I've got all my liberties kind of thing, so I'm fashioning my own God and my own religion. God gives us pleasures in this life, and he gives us gifts in this life. He gives us food to enjoy, relationships to enjoy. He gives us sex to enjoy in marriage. He gives us entertainment. He gives us possessions to enjoy. He gives us position and ministries and things like that to enjoy, and they're not bad. They are these blessings, they're good. But we can find ourselves turning them into idols and bowing down to them and serving them instead of serving the one who gave that to us. So gifts can be turned into gods or idols. Goals in our life can become gods or idols. Anything we start to live for and strive for and serve or sacrifice for can become a god or an idol in our life. There is the god of public opinion. or fear of man. That we are so concerned about what they say about us. And if I start making my decisions on what they say about me, guess what? I've just elevated them above the place that God is supposed to have in my life. Because I should really only care about what He thinks about me. So caring more about what they or a person thinks, fearing their opinion, fearing their disapproval or whatever it might be, over what God thinks, then now that has taken the place of an idol. The gods of success or personal achievements. The gods of success appeal to our self-sufficiency. Now, we're taught, especially as women today, we're taught to be independent, very self-sufficient, very strong women, right? And that feeds that part of our flesh, and then those things can creep in and become idols in our lives, our abilities, our accomplishments. And it can be in a variety of different places, even in the kitchen. You know, we're Susie Homemaker, or we make the best cinnamon rolls, or whatever it might be. And that's that can become our identity. It can become an idol in our lives. We can be very successful in the bedroom and really elevate that, or on the job, our career, or what we've accomplished, the pats on the back that we get, or as a leader in any kind of setting. As a mom, we can, it's our personal achievement. We're a good mom, or we're the best wife. Or in the sewing room, or the craft room, or the hobby room, we can, because we're being thrifty. We're the queen of the coupons. We know how to get a good bargain, and we have that personal achievement, that success in doing that thing, or at the gym, or healthy eating, or being organized, or being the best homeschool mom, or we complete our daily checklist all the time, and or we even, again, we fashion our own religion, and now we've mastered it, so we can pat ourselves and, you know, we're this god of success. All those things are fine to be good at, but when they start rising up and we care more about that than we care about the Lord, that's a danger. That's on its way or is an idol in our lives. What about the god of money? Mark Twain wrote, "Some men worship rank, some worship heroes, some worship power, some worship God, and over these ideals they dispute and cannot unite, but they all worship money." You know, Jesus spoke 38 parables, and 16 of those 38 deal with the subject of money. Now, we know that whenever he repeats himself, it means take heed and listen 16 times. He knows that money often competes for our heart. And money can be a very subtle idol in our lives. Kyle Idleman, who wrote that book, he said, "The key to keeping money in its right place is to remember that it all belongs to Him. All of it." How quickly we forget that. He asks these questions. Are you looking to money to do for you what God wants to do for you? That is a good question. Am I trusting in money, or am I trusting in God to provide this for me? How we handle our money has a way of answering that question. He said, "What is your attitude toward giving? What emotions do you feel when you're asked to give? What percentage of your income do you currently give away?" Deuteronomy 14:23 in the Living Bible says, "The purpose of tithing is to teach you to always put God first in your life." Isn't that interesting? The purpose of tithing is so that we learn to put God first. Giving money away breaks its power over you. So when you give it away, he said, you're saying to the money, you are so unimportant to me that I can just give you away. When is the last time you looked in your wallet and said that? Or your bank account and said that? You, I don't care about you at all. If you want to find out how important money is to you, start giving it away. I don't think anybody escapes this one. It is a battle for every single person. Even if we're a giving person, still, we have to have our little stash or whatever it is. I mean, none of us are exempt. It's something I think we have to fight all the time. But we need to fight it and not give in to it. And maybe those things stung some of us, but it's a good sting. When I was a brand new Christian, I've shared this story before, but when I was a brand new Christian, my sister-in-law wanted to have a yard sale, and I really don't care for those kind of things, and I don't care to go to yard sales, and I don't care to have yard sales. I would rather give it away, because I just can't deal with all that. So anyway, but we had one, and I made some money, and I liked that. It doesn't matter. You can be poor and you can have a lot of money and you can still have money as an idol. I mean, it doesn't matter, rich or poor. And I was always the kid on the block who had the allowance, who bought candy for the other kids. So it wasn't like I never had money. But I got this garage sale money. This is my money, right? It's my money. And so, but I knew, because I was a good Christian, I'm going to tithe out of this garage sale money because that's what you do. It's God's first, and I'm going to give him 10%. And so I got all ready to do that, and the Lord spoke to me and said, I want you to give it all. Excuse me? All? In my baggies with my coins and my dollar bills and things, you know? And I probably had $25 at that time. But that was mine. It was my money. That was a struggle. I mean, that sounds so stupid, but it was a struggle. But I'm obedient, so I'm going to do that. And so here, you know, Sunday morning, and the bag's coming. I got my little baggies. Okay, you know. That's just ridiculous. But that's how, you know, that's what's in the heart of us all. What about the gods of entertainment? God often loses when competing with the gods of entertainment for time and attention in our lives, TV, movies, video games, hobbies, any recreational activities, which again are all okay, but not when they come before the Lord. How much time is lost by watching TV or being on social media? When I would rather spend my time doing those things than spending it with the Lord, something is wrong. Something's out of whack. And that can be a daily challenge for some of us. And it's a daily check for some of us that we have to, on a daily basis, go, okay, I'm going to give you more time and less time to this. If I run to those hobbies or entertainment or whatever it might be, those things for escape, rather than running to the Lord, then something's wrong. Something's wrong. Now, putting a movie on and escaping because you're tired or whatever, I mean, I'm not saying that's wrong, but when that's my first reaction and I do it too much, it's an idol warning. It's a red flag. Something's out of whack here. The God of control. Now, I thought this is very interesting. Now, we all have control issues, right? I mean, some are very obvious, but we all have subtle ones. The need for control, or control, takes many different forms. It looks different in all of our lives, but it can get a hold of our hearts. The more control we have, the more control we want, and then pretty soon that is controlling us. Kyle Eidelman suggests that gods at times form dark alliances of cooperation with each other. Maybe the god of control is working with the god of comfort. Because yes, your need to cover every detail speaks of a drive to stay as snug within your comfort zone as possible. And so you think the issue is anxiety, while perhaps the real issue is that the gods of control and comfort are winning the war for your heart. Very interesting and convicting, When we control our lives and our environment for our comfort and our convenience without taking God into consideration, without talking to Him about it, then He's not the one controlling our lives. We are. When I want to be comfortable, and I found myself within the last couple of years getting into this, and then it was like warning. I want to be comfortable. I don't want to do that. I've had too many hard things. I want easy right now. And so if I want to stay home and be all by myself, then that's what I want to do. But is that what the Lord wanted me to do? And that was the issue. And that's what He was talking to me about. You might want to do that, and you might think you need that, Karen, but you need to be with me and my people right now and get out of your comfort zone. The gods of disappointments. Disproportionate disappointment reveals that we have placed intense hope and longing in something other than God. Erwin Lutzer writes, "Have you ever thought, and no, I hadn't, but I do now, and so will you, have you ever thought that our disappointments are God's way of reminding us that there are idols in our lives that must be dealt with?" Ooh. Recently, I will confess, I have been a glutton. The month of December is easy to be a glutton, and it's a sin. And so December and January, I just rebelled and ate what I wanted to eat, which are sweets. Do I want that cake or do I want that cake? And it's, the god of comfort, control, because I wanted cake. There's nothing wrong with having a piece of cake, but when you have cake over and over, somebody gives me half a cake. Okay, fine, I have a piece. Nothing wrong with that. Then what happens to me is I want another piece. So then I eat two pieces, and then it makes me sick, so I go to bed saying, I am never eating cake again, and I will not have that cake. That cake makes me sick. I'm not having that cake tomorrow. What happens tomorrow about 12, 1 o'clock? You're not sick anymore. I think I'll have one more piece of cake. And, it's terrible. It's just stupid. It's terrible, but it's a sin. It was a sin. It's just horrible. So I have crushed that god and put God back on the throne, and He's helping me now not eat cake or any other bad things. I happen to be starving right now, but no. The gods of love and relationships. When we look at someone other than God to complete us and define our lives, it's idolatry. They can't be tied for first place. They can't be second place. God's supreme. He is first, he is second, he is third, he is fourth. He is on the throne. And this can be really difficult, I think, for women more so maybe than men. And it can be very difficult for some in marriage with their husbands. Maybe their husbands rescued them, brought them out of a horrible life, whether poverty or abuse or, I mean, something. And they just have this Prince Charming, wonderful husband. And so they absolutely adore their husband. I mean, we should adore our husbands. We should love our husbands. But, you know, it's just like he's raised to a position that he shouldn't have. They depend heavily on everything for him. We can understand it, but it can get out of whack. It can also be very difficult as moms. If you're a mom, you understand that. Probably most moms have had to put a check on this sometime through their motherhood to make sure that their kids don't come first and their kids don't come before their husbands. And their kids especially don't come before the Lord. Augustine, an early Christian leader and writer, he called the gods of relationship and family disordered loves. I liked that. It just explains a lot. It's love, but it's disordered, out of order. Which, of course, then leads into my story and my life lesson. Years ago, probably maybe, I don't know, 15 years ago, I was with a friend. We were in a car and we were driving, and she was going through a very hard time with her older children. I think they had graduated, and they weren't walking with the Lord and, you know, causing her all kinds of heartbreak and everything. And her love for them and her concern for them and her worry for them was keeping her awake at night. For those of you who are moms, you understand, very easy to do. And she told me that she had realized that her kids were her idols. They were in a place that they shouldn't have in her life. She was reading a certain devotion, and she gave me a quote out of it, or she told me the quote. I'd like to have it in writing, but she can't remember what book she read it from. And so anyway, she realized that, and it was really hard for her, and she's trying to deal with that and trying to put God in his rightful place and get the kids out of there. Not easy, not easy thing to do. And so as she was sharing with me, I'm like, wow, okay. And I did a quick heart check, you know, because that's kind of what I do when I'm talking with people. Okay, you know, where am I? That really ministered to me. Where am I, Lord? Blah, 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 blah. Well, I determined that my kids weren't my idol because I didn't stay awake at night. I worried during the day. I bet I could sleep at night. Therefore, they're not my idols. What an idiot. Then a few years ago, I was with a different friend, and we were talking, and she was sharing with me her struggles and her concerns over her adult children who were not walking with the Lord, and the blame she had put on herself, because that's what we do as moms. The hours of prayer she has spent, and more hours of worry that she has spent, the emotional turmoil that she is going through over her children's decisions and their lifestyle choices, and on and on and on. And then she realized that her children had become idols too. And she called it, and I've shared this phrase before, she called it a mother's heart run wild. Disordered love, a mother's heart run wild. And I just thought, amen. Because at that time, I had already known that I had put my own children on that place where only God should have. And so we talked, and as friends do, you talk, and that iron sharpening iron, and you say, this is how I feel, and this is my struggle here, and I hear you, and I, you know, they're ministering to you, and you're ministering to them, and, you know, it's good. We need to do that when we're in the same boat, and we see how the other person sees it and all that. So I'm not making any excuses for myself. But I will say it was really easy for me to put my children in that place that only God should have. Because, again, it's not an excuse, but it's in my gene pool and it's been modeled to me. And that's what I thought was normal. And the other day, Damien and I were talking, and we talk about, you know, all kinds of things, but I brought this one up, and I don't know why, because, you know, so many things pop into my head and I talk about them. But, you know, I was talking about him, and I said, you know, if God hadn't called us to do what we were doing, I said, you know, you would have been a very good lawyer. He has that mind, he has a temperament, so you would have been a very good lawyer, or you would be a very good teacher. You know, he wanted to teach history, you know. And then, of course, we know how we are as wives. And then, now, what would you think I would have been good at? You know, what job or what position or what would I have done well in, you know? And he, because you know how he is, well, maybe you don't, but, you know, he's very, you know, when I'm waiting and waiting, you know, and then so I start answering, you know, well, I wouldn't have wanted to be a nurse. No, I would rather be a surgeon than a nurse. And, you know, you're going on. And he said, you know, he said, that's very hard to answer because you are so maternal. I can't think of anything other than what you've done. When Damien and I got married, I actually called him my idol for a time and my hero. I was so madly in love with him. I wanted to give him my all, and because I'm maternal and I'm nurturing and I'm loving and I like to touch, and I was always touching him and squeezing him, and I still do. I'll walk into his office and rub his shoulders when he's studying or whatever. It just is in me. And so, you know, completely, my life is him. We didn't know the Lord. Not that that probably would have mattered, but, you know, he was the one who consumed my thoughts. Then we had our first daughter. And when, as a new mom, you spend every minute with that baby. And the way that I was, you know, there's no babysitter. There is nothing. It's me 100% of the time, playing and talking and, you know, all of that, because I absolutely loved it. Damien was working very hard. He was working 10-hour days to provide for us. He would work on weekends sometimes. When he got home, he'd work on the house or work out in the yard. So I didn't get to spend as much time as I wanted to with him. And I felt my emotions and my feelings shift toward that little baby, because that was real easy to do. I got to love somebody. I've got to take care of somebody. And so you, little one, you need me, and he's pretty independent. But I do remember sitting on the couch one day when she was probably only about 4 months old. I did not know the Lord, but I know the Lord spoke to me. And I was looking out the sliding glass door at Damien out there working in the yard, and I looked at this little baby, and I said, I have a choice. I have a choice right now, because I'm afraid this little one is going to become more important to me than that one that I married out there, and I can't let that happen. I've seen that. I don't want to do that. So I had to make a choice, and I did make a choice. And I chose every day through the years to not put them first. Now, obviously, I put them first and he's not demanding, he's pretty easy, and the kids are demanding and all that. So it got out of whack at times, but it was in my head. I'm gonna die with this man. They're gonna leave me. I gotta invest into that. And so that's what I have done over the years. Now, when we came to know the Lord, our girls were 3 and 1. And I learned about the authority structure in the home. I learned what a biblical family's supposed to be, what our priority's supposed to be. I learned that I needed to keep God first and foremost in my life. I needed to love him with my heart, mind, soul, and strength. And I thought, oh boy, this is not easy. Especially when I read the verse in Matthew 10:37, when Jesus said, "He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Oh, my word. I thought, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then I thought, okay, you get the right teaching and everything. Okay, he's not telling me to love my family less. He's telling me to love him more. So I got to work on that. I've got to grow in that. I have to get to know him more so that my love and my passion is strong for him and not less for them, but it's more for him. And as we all do, we grow in the Lord and we walk with the Lord, and that's what we're all aiming for. But somewhere along the way, I got a little mixed up and didn't even realize it, because it's a subtle thing. These idols, no matter what it is, they're subtle. They're subtle. And I didn't realize that I was not putting God first in these relationships, because, of course, you gauge it differently. I go to church, I lead a Bible study, I worship the Lord, I love the Lord, I pray, I do all these things. I love you, Lord. But in these little areas, it was out of whack. I didn't realize that my identity and my purpose in my mind and in my heart was as a mother and as a grandmother, and I didn't place it in the Lord, and I didn't know it. I didn't realize that what they thought of me and their approval of me was more important, because I already knew the Lord would love me no matter what. But I got to gain this from them because I feel like I'm losing it. So I elevated them. And I didn't realize how much fulfillment was in my heart and satisfaction and joy was in my family, my children, my grandchildren. They were my sanctuary when things were hard in ministry or warfare or life. I could run to my safe place. And I didn't realize that I had begun to find my self-worth in them. One time I heard this statement: a mother is only as happy as her least happy child. And that has some truth to it, right? Because when our child, one of our children, is sick or struggling or whatever it might be, it makes us sad. It's natural. It's normal. It makes us sad. So we're really only as happy then, that emotion, happy, as our least happy child. But if my happiness is determined by their happiness, then something's out of whack. If I only have peace and peace of mind when they have peace, something's out of whack. Kyle Eidelman told a story about a mom in the book that got, she did all of the, she was like the Proverbs 31 woman and mom and homeschooled and baked cookies and took care of and, all that we have conjured up in our minds that a Christian mother is supposed to be. And she took pride in the fact that she was such a loving, wonderful mother. But she writes, and she said, "When my children have the power to fill me with anger or peace, with disappointment or joy, they are controlling who I am as a person and changing from who I was meant to be. And that is so true. When they start controlling me, and I'm happy because they're happy, and I'm disappointed because they're disappointed, and this and that, they have now controlled me. No longer the Lord. It's them. And that is what happened, or what I allowed. Not on purpose. I didn't even know it. Until you get a big, you know, the Lord reveals it. I also didn't realize that when criticism came from my children and I felt at fault, because it had to be true, and then tried then to live up to expectations that they had of me, that should have been a huge red flag of idolatry. But it wasn't. I was blinded in the name of love. Disordered love, but I didn't know that. It was love. It was what I thought a loving mother was supposed to be. You give all. You do all. You sacrifice everything. Who am I supposed to give all to? Who am I supposed to sacrifice to? There's only one. One, and that's God. I got it all messed up in the name of love. Then I felt like a failure as a mother, less of a person. And I even became very insecure in things that had always been very natural for me to do. I couldn't do them anymore. I couldn't do them. I felt insecure. I wasn't good enough. I wasn't, you know. Then I began walking on eggshells to try to please, to try to gain approval, not rock the boat or not be the cause of the problem that I didn't know I was, but I guess I am. Have you ever walked on eggshells around anyone, any relationship? Is it the worst thing ever? Mm-hmm. Walking on eggshells is a sure sign of idolatry. I found that out. I didn't know it at the time because I thought I was helping not rock the boat. I thought I was being a peacemaker. I was preferring others over myself. I was extending grace to those around me. No, in reality, I was enabling and I was empowering. I had given them a place that only God should have in my life. These are things that the Lord doesn't show you all at once. It's little by little. An incident or this or that or whatever, and he starts to, you know, take those scales and off of your eyes and soften your heart and make you like, whoa, wow, okay. So then the Lord began to show me my motives. Why? Well, why? Why are you enabling? Why are you empowering? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? I'm analytical, I got to know why am I doing this so I can stop doing this? And he showed me why on all these things. Once I was accused of, in a very disrespectful way, of being obsessed with a child. And obviously that was very hurtful and offensive. But in my heart and mind, I thought, obsessed? This is out of love and concern. She's going off a cliff. I am out of love, but it's a disordered love. Mother's heart run wild. And what the accuser didn't know is I feel the same way about you. It's my mother's heart out of whack, big time. The Lord showed me, definitely, yes, your family, your children, your grandchildren have become your idols. This is not agape love, Karen. This is out of fear. It's out of a selfish love for yourself. For yourself. Because a fear of them not loving me or approving. I couldn't stand that. I couldn't stand that. And he showed me that I was bowing down to, catering to, making decisions based on their schedules and their needs or what they would think. And who should have that place in my life? Only God. And I don't say any of this to blame anyone. The blame is right standing in front of you. Because I allow that. I did that until God delivered me. Praise his holy name. He's shown me these things. It delivered me from this sin of idolatry. And the confession has been so good, so cleansing. And this recent time in our family's lives, which is, you know, very public, I do not believe for 1 second that this was all because of my idolatry. Absolutely not. Trials come into our lives for a lot of reasons, and they're always bigger than what our opinions are of them. He works everything. He's working so many things. And I mean, your luggage can be lost on vacation, and it's not about your luggage. He's got a bigger thing going on. It's about you, the attitude of your heart, how you're speaking to the airline who lost your luggage. I mean, this is, you know, I mean, that's just a minor thing. But trials are way bigger. So it is through this trial that he has brought these things to my attention and used them for my good and theirs one day. Fenelon said, "You must renounce those you love best, your family and your friends, and be ready to lose them if God takes them away. Never try to find your heart's true rest in them, or you will experience the jealousy of God. God rejects a bride who divides herself between the bridegroom and the stranger." And then Kyle Eidelman said, "Taking disordered love or relationships off of that center and putting Jesus in the rightful place is the most loving thing we can do for those we love." Amen for that. Jesus is the center. You know, I've been reading this other book, and he's been over the weeks talking about Jesus is the center. He's the hub of a wheel, that hub, and then the spokes come out. And so these spokes are our relationships with people or other things that can become idols. And if one of them starts creeping into the hub and takes that place, the whole thing's going to be out of whack. Only Jesus can make that life, that wheel, or that your life go correctly. When he is in the center, he's in control because he is supreme. He is the only worthy one. Our God is a jealous God, a consuming fire. Deuteronomy, and you don't have to turn there, but read it later. Chapter 4, verses 15 through 24, deal with idolatry. He said, "For the Lord your God is a consuming fire and a jealous God." We typically think of jealousy with negativity, right? Someone who's insecure or out of control or, you know, trying to control. But it is out of love that God is jealous for us. He is our creator, and he's possessive of his creation. He has a plan and a purpose for our lives. He doesn't want interference. He doesn't want competition because he knows that will harm us. God considers idolatry spiritual adultery. What husband would allow his wife to wander, to seek attention from another man or give another man attention? He would be jealous. And it would be offensive and hurtful to her if he wasn't. Well, God does it out of perfect love. Fenelon said, "What he is after is what comes between you and him. He will not rest, and neither will you, I might add, until you have given him everything." What a comfort, freedom, and strength there is when nothing stands between you and God. Amen to that. I'm not going to read this because I don't have time, but Spurgeon wrote a great thing on the jealousy of God. Damien has said over and over again throughout the years, it takes a passion to conquer a passion. Kyle Eidelman said, idols are defeated not by being removed, but by being replaced with God, with who is supposed to be there. It takes a passion for God to conquer this passion for our children, for our husband, for our job, for money, for things, for whatever it might be, food, whatever, entertainment. It takes a passion for Him. E. Stanley Jones prays, "O God, I lay down the burdens of trying to be God, for I am not God, you are. So I yield to you the throne. I abdicate it now and forever, and I am relieved and released? I am. I'm grateful that I now no longer am centered in myself. I'm centered in you." Father, hard, hard lesson for me, for my life, and I'm sure for the women in this room who I've just realized they have an idol on the throne of their lives. And Father, you are so gentle and yet so firm, and you love us so much that you don't want anything or anyone to compete. And Lord, I am ashamed that I let anything or anyone in. And Father, thank you for loving us enough to show us, loving us enough that you're jealous of us and that you will not let anyone take that place for very long in our lives. Lord, may they be dethroned tonight and may you take your rightful place. May no rival throne survive in our hearts and in our lives, Lord. Take this message, take the truth and the power of your word and work in us. In Jesus' name, amen.